Have the absolute delight of welcoming to teach with me a colleague of mine at Union Theological Seminary. Well, I'll let introduce herself.
Yes, I'm Lisa Stone Hazelwood, and I know a little bit about this topic, and I got pulled in with Dan at the last minute, so I'm learning with you about what we're about to do to some extent.
Lisa and I are both students of Christian Ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. And both of us have deep interest and concern about the environmental situation, the ecological crisis. And this session, which by the way for the Tate Ministry is entitled Kinship with Creation, Kinship of Creation.
Rethinking environmental ethics.
Exactly. Came about mostly because we saw there wasn't much on the agenda this week with it, and it's a topic we think is really important, and so we agreed we would pull this together. And are delighted to do so. The way we thought we'd focus this is sort of in three parts. We want to start by introducing, or for some of you it may be review, but a study document that's currently underway in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America called Caring for Creation, Vision, Hope, and Justice. And I hope everybody has access to at least see one. We passed several copies around. You're welcome to take these with you when we leave. We want to get them out as widely as possible. So Lisa and I will spend a few minutes introducing the document and some of the major emphases in it, how it was put together. Then we'd like to have you, for about 20 minutes, spend some time in small groups discussing some questions that really get at how we see ourselves related to the rest of the natural order. And then we'd like to come back and for the third of the third time to come together and talk about some of those things and debrief them and see what the church's response might be in that. But let me just begin by asking, how many folks have seen this a draft of this study document before? It's Caring for Creation, Vision, Hope, and Justice. Okay, may not have had too wide of distribution yet in the church. In just a moment, we're going to go over the sort of the logic and how it's laid out. What I thought I might do, though, is just mention briefly what a social statement of the church is, how it comes about and what function it plays, so we understand what the context is for creating this document. Basically, a social statement of the church, at least in the Lutheran church, is a corporate statement of theological reflection on a specific social issue. So some examples of that, of taking a specific social issue and then reflecting together theologically on it, are statements that the church has put out on abortion, or in this case, the environmental crisis. The current church is currently working on one on human sexuality. But these are chances for the church to reflect together on key social issues and to bring a theological perspective to them. Now, the statements that we have here is a draft. They're arrived at by a deliberative process that has at least a couple different phases to it. The underlying assumption is that in addition for the church to being a worshiping community, the church is also a community that reflects on the moral issues together, or what we call a community of moral deliberation. It's a chance where we come and bring our values together, reflect together about how we approach the problems of the world. And the document is put together a combination of a committee and staff. If you look on page 15 here, the last inside the end cover, it lists who are the members of the Environment Task Force that have put together much of this draft. But it's not simply the word of experts then propagated to the church, because first draft is put together and then it's distributed as widely as possible to get people's information and feedback, critique, so forth. That's where we are with this phase here. So one of the things we want to talk about at the end of this session is what kind of feedback we would give to this, and then we're going to encourage all of you folks to write to them, the task force, to give them this feedback. They really, really, really want this feedback. And so as much as we can give them, be terrific. If any of you have worked in this kind of process, you realize also you tend to hear from the people who are disgruntled and unhappy. And if there are things that we're disgruntled and unhappy about, we certainly want to write them. But if there are things that we're proud about or happy about, think that there's a good positive statement, we also need to give that feedback. So we'll come back to that in a minute. Finally, the purpose of these social statements is twofold. It's meant to give guidance to individuals in the church, moral guidance, so it is non-binding. These are not coercive statements, but they are meant to give us guidance in our individual lives, in our family lives, in our community lives. It's more binding on the institution. It's meant to give guidance to the institution in terms of its own policies, and it's less optional for the church as an institution to ignore its own social statements. But at the level of individuals, it's meant as moral guidance. Any questions on that very brief overview of social statements before we actually look at this statement itself? Okay, well, let's go ahead now so we can get right to the discussion part. Lisa and I are going to divide this up. I'm going to do the first three Roman numerals, and she's going to do the latter three sections there. And just since you have copies of this, we're not going to go into too much detail. What we mostly want to do is point out to you the kind of logic that informs this, how this was put together. After you read the preface here, born by God's promise, it's important to realize that for Lutherans at least, and I would say Christians in general, the approach we take to social problems is always within the context of the promise of the gospel. So that is what motivates us, that is what it shapes our approach to things. And so it's born by God's promise that we're even bold enough to face the environmental crisis that is hitting the planet today. Now within that, the first section in here is one called the urgency. For people who do ethics or theology and so forth, we always talk about the first step is doing social analysis. You need to know what the problem is before you can address it. And that's what's happening here in this little section called the urgency. If you read through it there, they'll give several examples about the kinds of problems that face us with the environment now, and the fact that we don't have much time in which to address them. That's where the urgency comes from. It's our analysis of the situation and the time in which we have to address them. And so many of these, I think, are familiar to us, things like global warming, toxic chemicals, so forth. But the premise here is that the problems are real and the problems are urgent. They need our response. Now, the second step, then, is what informs our response. And the statement here takes three sections called the vision. This is laying out the theological vision that helps us understand how we're going to respond. Let me give you an example of a different theological vision, one that was common in the early church that the church competed with. This theological vision said that there were two forces in the world, the force of evil and the force of good, and that the body reality of the world was evil. And therefore, the only way to get away from evil was to deny your bodies, to deny the earth, and flee into the spirit world. Comes under various names, but Manichaeism is one of them. And if you're familiar with Augustine, you may have gone to Jim Brandt's talk in Augustine. He may have talked about that. That is a competing worldview that sets up a vision that then influences how you respond. Now, Christianity has consistently claimed the opposite. It has said that rather than being evil, the created earth is good, and is very good. And so the statement here that God, earth, and all creatures lays out that affirmation that not only humanity is good, but all of creation is a good gift of God. The second sense there lays out the biblical vision of our place in creation. And a shorthand way of looking at that would be the whole notion of being good stewards. That God has placed us as stewards over the rest of creation to have loving dominion. The same way God has dominion over us, then we are to have dominion over the rest of the earth. Now, we're going to come back in our small groups and have you talk about whether you think that's the most appropriate model for our relationship to the rest of the natural order today. But that's the dominant biblical model in the Old Testament, one of loving dominion. It's counterbalanced by some other tendencies, however, and one of them about line 17 on page 4, comes from Paul's vision in Romans that the entire creation is still longing for fulfillment and that in the incarnation in Jesus, God is bringing about a new creation, all right? So it's a sense of not only kind of static caretaking, but that all creation is moving towards a new fulfillment. And that again is part of the theological vision that shapes how we approach the problem. The third little emphasis under the vision here is the Christian view of sin and forgiveness. The understanding that there is a brokenness that we live amidst in the reality here. And in this case, the brokenness has led to the environmental crisis. The degradation of the environment is a manifestation of our sinfulness. So Christianity calls for, once we recognize sin, for repentance. That is turning around from sin and moving in a different direction. that again is part of the vision, part of the urgency. Somehow our sinful behavior is causing the degradation of the planet. We need to repent from that and move into another direction. Now, one of the key emphases in here is then, if the vision is what guides us, the hope is what motivates us. This is our faith that God has already brought about salvation of the world and is bringing about the new creation, and this gives us hope in Jesus Christ. A couple emphases again in here. One is that hope is a gift. It's a free gift of God that's given freely to us that we can claim and trust. And that, again, frees us into this, able to believe the gift of hope. Now, if you have your book there, look on page 6. I want to just point out a couple things there. Starting about line 13, that second paragraph, just note here the relationship between human sin and in the degradation of the environment. God does not just heal a creation wounded by human sin. That's part of it. We have faith that God is healing the creation wounded by human sin, but that's not all God does. God, in addition, sustains and renews the whole creation. God is active in creation whether or not we are, sustaining and renewing it. So when we talk about ecological systems that are mutually supportive, we as Christians interpret that as God's sustaining and renewing hand present in the ecology. Now, this next line is important. Although nature itself has not sinned, okay, it's not nature that's sinful, it is in captivity and looks forward to a final fulfillment. That's part of the Christian vision. It's one of the things we're going to want to come back and talk about, what that might mean and whether or not we agree with that. But the vision is that nature is part of the captive earth and is longing for fulfillment the same way human beings are. The second one in here is that this hope is not a passive hope, it's a hope that takes place in action. We are longing and waiting for the second coming, for the time of the fulfillment of this renewal creation, but it's not a passive waiting. God expects us to be good stewards, expects us to take care of the creation, expects us to live in just, harmonious relationships in the meantime. That's what it means to be part of the community of Christ, giving witness to the new creation even while we live in the midst of brokenness. So that little section lays out some of that theology there. That's sort of the problem, the urgency, what shapes our vision and what motivates us. And now we want to look at what guides our vision here.
Exactly. In the fourth section, we start to talk about how it is that we can be faithful to the vision that you can read about in this book. How it is that we can be faithful to our vision of loving and serving and keeping the earth. And the study comes up with, I think, four very good guides or principles or norms that we can both look at in terms of our thinking and our acting and evaluate what exactly we should do, what exactly our response as individuals and a church should be to what sometimes seems like an overwhelming problem of this environmental crisis. So on page 7, we look at justice. The four ethical norms that they talk about are at the bottom. The first one being solidarity, justice through solidarity, which means not only solidarity with other people, but they talk about solidarity with the earth, which we might also want to touch on in terms of our human relationship to the non-human rest of creation. It means joining together as fellow sister travelers and strugglers. It means hearing other voices and, again, also hearing the cry of the earth in this time. The second kind of justice they talk about is justice through sustainability. And that means the ability to both develop and preserve this resource, this gift of creation of which we are a part. And I like to think about sustainability the way that Wendell Berry does, who's a poet, someone you might have read or heard about. He's a farmer in Kentucky. He talks about sustainability just like this report does, in terms of sustainability in agriculture is an agriculture that depletes neither the soils nor people. And I think this report agrees that sustainability doesn't only mean sort of the sustainability of the natural creation, but also recognizes the sort of demands we make economically and otherwise as people involved in our work, in communities involved in our needing to meet our own human needs. So it's a very balanced view of what sustainability means. The third section is justice through sufficiency. This reminds us that justice means meeting our human needs, that we need to meet those sufficiently for shelter, for food, for clean water, for clothing, and for those things that allow us to live a healthy and fulfilling life. It also reminds us that there are haves and have-nots, and that part of the question of justice in light of sufficiency calls upon us to make sure that everyone's needs are met sufficiently. The fourth one is justice through participation, which as a guide reminds us that a maximally inclusive process helps us to hear all those voices we talked about in the second one, and also to realize to involve both the powerful and the less powerful in decisions that affect all of our interconnected future and certainly the fate of the earth in this time. So those are the four main guides and principles. Finally, again, they realize that sin is a reality and that we make mistakes. And sometimes we have to act on faith without knowing whether or not our solution is necessarily without its errors or without its negative consequences. So that's sort of the final part of that section.
Can I just point out one thing while we're still on justice here? Something that Lisa and I were talking about that both of us agree is critically important contribution of this document is that it doesn't separate justice issues from environmental issues, but rather it says they have to be treated together. And this is, oftentimes we'll hear things like, you know, the people of Brazil are cutting down the rainforest, and it becomes an issue between the poor of Brazil and saving the rainforest. This is very clear that we can't deal with the environment without also dealing with justice issues for the poor. And so justice becomes what informs how we work with the environmental issue and in the ways we face those issues.
Right, okay, so we move from there to the commitments that we, the people of the Lutheran Church are moving towards. And I think that this is really the beginning points for our own action or how we vision our own action. The first is the vision of our faith that we started to talk about up here. That's a starting point. It's a vision of our createdness, of God's unceasing and continuing involvement in creation, sustaining of creation. It's also a vision that includes Jesus' saving significance for all of creation, as Dan pointed out, particularly in reference to Romans 8. Secondly, the urgency of the issue commits us to action that is not simply further study. I think thirdly, it's not just requiring individual action, but the document also calls for institutional action, whether that's as a church or in public institutions, private corporations. It's calling us as a church and as individuals to witness in a broad sort of range of places in our lives. Fourthly, the guide suggests that we're committed to the diversity of opinions again, of allowing the church to encompass some opposing views, and to allow those opposing views and differences of opinions to work with us to strengthen our position and resolve, to really hear each other and to move together towards some very fruitful discussion. I think particularly in light of this, those who are most directly impacted by whether an issue or a solution, the caring for creation sort of upholds and uplifts as those who should be involved. Finally, we get to just the sort of specific areas where we could make commitments as a church. The suggestions starting on page 10 for ways in which our worship and education could change to encompass these concerns. For example, creation awareness centers. A congregation could become a place where people are talking and acting and struggling with ways to become more aware of our place in the natural order and the response that's required of us. We could secondly reflect creation emphases liturgically or in worship in a variety of ways. We commit here to developing new educational resources or to supporting those who are doing that kind of work. And fourthly, we commit to really doing some education programs in our own church to make ourselves more aware of what our responses could be. I think one of the main areas they end on is sort of the personal the personal lifestyle changes that I think some of us are being confronted with up at Holden for the first time, or maybe are very familiar with in our lifestyles at home. The ways we eat or transport ourselves or whatever that really have an impact on both modeling behavior for ourselves and for the institutions we're a part of. I think that is about all I wanted to say. Again, they end with the promise and the hope, the faith that God is continually working in us and in creation, and that together we're moving towards a fulfillment in Jesus. So that's the document.
Let's just pause here and take a couple minutes. We realize we went through this very quickly.
Yes.
And what we're going to do is pick out one particular section of it and have a series of questions we'd like you to focus more closely on, particularly having to do with the relationship between humanity and other parts of the natural order. But are there questions of clarification or comments before we do that, or concerns that people want to raise before we break into the small groups? We also, I should say, strongly encourage you to take this with you and study it more carefully, especially read the first page where it talks about how they're soliciting your input for it. Other things that weren't clear or don't make sense to you about how it was laid out? Or
are most documents laid out a similar way, you know, social statement documents? Because I think it makes a lot of sense the way it flows.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm appreciative of it, but is this sort of common?
Boy, I can't really answer that.
You know, the couple other ones I've seen, I think this is fairly common in the sense of you lay out the problem, you lay out our theological vision and how that shapes our response, and then you lay out different ways that the church can respond. I think that overall structure is fairly common. I also say it's good theology.
The document on theological education is structured in similar kinds of ways. It's a little different kind of thing, just because it has different kinds of issues involved with that. But
yeah.
I mean, it's very thoughtfully dealt with and addressed.
If you look at the document on human sexuality, even though it's got several other more sections because it has several subsections, it still tries to give good information and then talk about the church's traditional theological resources and then suggest ways we move towards the future. So I think that is common. Should we go ahead and move into
Yeah.
We decided to focus on the relationship between humanity and the rest of the natural order for a number of reasons, but one of the key ones is this is one of the things that's most being debated within the environmental movement, and it really shapes how you respond to that. There was a very provocative essay 20, 25 years ago by Lynn White, who made the claim that the environmental catastrophe and crisis directly comes out of the Judeo-Christian model of stewardship, of having dominion over the earth, because dominion was translated into domination, and therefore it laid the groundwork for exploiting the earth. Since that debate was open 25 years ago, there's been a lot of debate about what is the best appropriate model for the way humanity relates to the rest of the earth. So we're going to focus on that as our topic today, because that in itself shapes then how we see our best response to problems. The way we'd like to do it would be to have you read together the sections under the vision, starting on page 3. It's a short section. We'd like you to read section A, entitled God, Earth, and All Creatures, and section B, Our Place in Creation. In terms of understanding the vision of the theology that this document's putting out there. And then address these questions here. Now, Lisa and I are going to alternate them here. The first one is one we just talked about. What do you think the relationship between humanity and the rest of the natural order should be? All right? The document's going to give one model, the model of stewardship, being placed as caregivers and being responsible over the rest of creation. But we want you to talk about what you think this relationship should be. Another model might be kinship, that we're all our family, and we are one member of the family, but not necessarily on top. So you can think about different models that you think are the most appropriate.
And that feeds obviously into the second question, which asks, is the stewardship model the best or most appropriate model for these times? What are other models? Well, Dan gave you a clue. In fact, the clue is even in the in the sort of topic kinship with creation that was on the board, in terms of looking at what are some other models in terms of our relationship and what might be the most appropriate. Or what are some of the things that you read, even in those two paragraphs or those two sections we pointed out, that give you other openings, that give us other openings for a model, a way of looking at our relationship to the rest of creation. There's some clues.
There are diverse voices within Scripture itself, as well as many of us are familiar with other traditions like Native Americans, African traditions that have a different understanding of the way we relate to the rest of the earth. This is a question that's meant to be just provocative in terms of the stewardship model. Does the rest of the natural order need our care and responsibility? That's an assumption of the stewardship model, that God has set us up to take care of and be responsible for the rest of the natural order. Is the rest of the natural order helped by our care? I'd like you to talk about that and see pros and cons of that. We'd like you to focus the bulk of this time on these three questions. If you find, however, that you've got immediate consensus and nothing else to talk about, we put a few more questions on here, which we'll also talk about in the large group.
Okay, the fourth one is whether or not living creatures have intrinsic worth or just instrumental worth or value. What we mean by that is intrinsic worth is value for their own sake. Instrumental value or worth we understand as value in light of humanity's use for a particular creature or resource. Is that clear? Does every creature and resource in all of the world have sort of intrinsic value or only instrumental value? And then
let me give you an example. See if you can tell me. Tell me whether this statement is, except for mice and cockroaches. Tell me whether this statement has intrinsic value or instrumental value logic. The rainforest must be saved because it might hold the cure for cancer.
Instrumental.
Good example there, okay? So that's it. Intrinsic value is the rainforest must be saved for its own sake. It's a value part of, for its own sake. If it meets human needs, it's instrumental. Oftentimes you'll find a balance of them. I'm not saying one is good and one is bad, but be clear about, we want to know whether, how that influences how we see the rest of the natural order. And so secondly then, particularly if you answer yes to this one, that other living creatures do have intrinsic value, then we want you to talk about how do we decide then when there are conflicts between human and non-human needs and wants. When do, for example, the rights of other species take precedence over human needs, or vice versa, and how do we begin to decide that? All right. And then finally, when we come back together,
we'll do that one.
Yeah, we'll be talking about what should the church's response be in terms of giving feedback to this. So we'll take about 20 minutes now to give you a chance to talk. Lisa and I will probably come around and listen in on some of your conversations. Any questions before you head into it? All right, focus on the first three, and then if you've got time, move on from there.
Well, judging from the level of conversation in the room, I think we had enough to talk about in the 20 minutes. And rather than setting the agenda for the 10 minutes or so we have left, we thought we would let you do that by asking each of the groups, what was the sort of direction that your group was going or tended to go. If you had to put it into one question or one sort of statement, what might it be? Now, it may be that someone has a different idea than someone else in your group, but what was the direction your group was going, and where might we go further together in a discussion?
We sort of discussed the issue of the traditional stewardship model may not necessarily be the appropriate model. We may call it stewardship, but we need to understand that there's an interdependency that's necessary with the environment that we live in, because eventually it will bite us if we go. And that's not what you normally think about a stewardship kind of thought. It's us doing that, and that we need to think about it probably in a different kind of way, or revise our definition, or revise what we think about stewardship. Mm-hmm. That it needs to be more of an interdependency kind of issue and an interdependency model, or that might be a way of looking at it better.
Sounds very good.
How did you understand traditional stewardship? What were some of the things, you know, that came to mind for you when you talk about you grew up with a traditional stewardship?
Well, I would think about church, right? I mean, you think about giving, time, talents, and all that kind of stuff. So that's where my idea of stewardship comes from. And, but you know, so what if I give my time to work here and work here? But
I'm the important thing and taking care of.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's very helpful. Yes, stewardship, even that word in its current usage, has much more to do with giving money. Or maybe time and talents. That's very helpful.
Well, yeah. I brought the philosophy that the stewardship model is incorrect in the sense that it makes the assumption that there's something wrong with the environment originally and that we need to take care of it. You know, it needs to be taken care of. You know, that there's something there that needs to be taken care of, so therefore there's something wrong in it. And so I felt that the kinship model was much more appropriate. However, Mary brought up, which I think is a very, very valid point, was that we have affected our earth so much at this point that the kinship model is not appropriate. We need to go to the stewardship model and really work, you know, with the environment in order to survive as a species.
Mary?
Sort of said, yeah, but I mean, you came up with maybe a mixed model makes more sense in this era. My point being, we've ruined so much of creation by our actions, that do we have some responsibility then to try to aid in the healing, or can we afford to sit back and wait for centuries of healing? I think we sort of agree that the earth, and I'm not a biologist or anything, but the earth generally would heal itself if we just back off in certain areas where we've made ruin, but do we have the time to back off? So in some ways, I think the earth in some areas needs our care and responsibility now with our knowledge of what we've done and what we can help. But it's a controversial area, and it's something I struggle with, because I just assume we allow natural healing, but I'm not sure.
That's a very interesting point you bring up, in that there may not be one model that's appropriate for all situations.
Sure.
We may need to really be looking carefully at different situations to know how we best interrelate.
And our image of the relationship of humans to non-human creation may be such that we feel a certain kinship, but again, given the time, feel called upon to act more in the traditional stewardship model, or caretaking model is maybe a better word, since stewardship seems.
We also talked about the differences of where humanity is in the environment. There are places in the world where to remove humans might cause a disruption in what has been a natural, for centuries and centuries, ecosystem, including humans. But that my general perspective of the Western is that hasn't been the case. As we've brought in too many humans to do too much, but that there are ways to spread that out.
Mm-hmm. Any other directions people were going?
You know, one of the illustrations of that is what they're doing with the tailings now. They're trying to increase the bioavailability of nutrients by actually working on the tailings area. It would take care of itself. We have another model in Alaska with glaciers. We have people studying glaciers as they recede. You can see the different changes, and that probably ought to be left alone and let it do that. But I'm not real sure about the tailings here. I think we need to be more interactive with that and address that issue, because that's something we've done.
What were some of the primary concerns and issues coming out of the groups over here?
One of the things that I thought about at the end of our discussion was that, I don't know because I haven't read the document, but it seems to leave out some of the assumptions that we make in terms of our scientific models, such as just the whole, I mean, most of us here, I would imagine, believe in the evolution of the Earth, and it seems to leave that whole science, the science model, the evolutionary model, and how do we, you know, take our biblical understandings of creation, how does that jive with what modern science now is saying? Are they in conflict? How do they come together? Where do they come together? Because I think that most people are influenced more by, say, evolutionary theory than by a creation view. I mean, science is almost like our new mythology. And it doesn't, the document, I didn't hear you and I didn't see in there addressing that at all.
Really interesting point, I think, good point. I just want to point out a particular book that I was talking with Lisa about that makes precisely that point. It's a book called The Liberation of Life, and it's co-written by a biologist and a theologian. And they start with the ecological models or evolutionary models of all interdependence of life as the way that then shapes how we understand our interrelatedness, moving away from a kind of a stewardship or a caretaker model. Hmm.
the stewardship model isn't too bad if you go back to what a steward was. He was not the owner. He was not the possessor. He was only the manager slash controller, shepherd type of person to leave the shepherd off to the side. That throws in sheep too. So the his whole function was to make sure that resources were used properly and replaced. The parable of the talents or of the stewards there. If you don't replace and magnify, out with you, kid. A manager can be fired if he doesn't do it right. The stewardship model would work if it were a stewardship model. It's not. It's
a dominion-based stewardship model, as opposed to a sort of love and care-based.
Well, and Lisa brings up one of the buzzwords here. As you hear the word dominion, what images does that bring up for you?
Well, we've used it as domination.
I just want to point out, come back to your point here, the devil's advocate, that one of my theology professors has pointed out that if we really believed in the biblical model of dominion, what the Bible does is ask us to exercise dominion the way God exercises dominion. And those of us who are Christian and believe in the incarnation believe that God exercises dominion through love, through servanthood, through justice. I mean, those are the biblical models of dominion. But why have we gotten so far away from that understanding of dominion when we relate to the natural world? There's some of those questions. I think you're right. If we were to take what are really more biblical models of stewardship and dominion, it might be a much more holistic relationship to the earth. But somehow we've gotten really far apart from that, at least in the West here.
Well, that may be because as the study says, creation isn't sinful, but dominion has become an issue among peoples. Who's in control and who's in charge of other people and who's going to have power over other people? And we've translated somewhere along the line that we also then have power over people. Even though the conflict maybe wasn't so clear there, as it is among sinful human beings fighting each other.
The flip side of that, I think, is again to make the link between justice for people and justice for the earth a strong one, because it seems to me it's the same sin that gets us into trouble, and it's the same liberation that we're looking for. Anyone from these other groups that want to talk about directions that they went?
One direction that we went on, we were looking at question number 3, and statement number 3. Mm. And kind of realize that sets the way it's phrased sets us apart from the rest of the natural, the rest of the natural order. We have to remember that as humanity, we are part of the whole natural order. And I believe that too many times in environmental talks and environmental issues, humanity is set apart as some evil villain automatically. But we are part of creation, and we are good. And that humanity is not the only species that uses other species to its advantage. The grizzly bear eats the salmon, the salmon eats little fish eat plankton. To link this all together with like the stewardship model and the kinship model, we said that for too long we have been in this, kind of stewardship model, and that the kinship model would be a good ideal. However, we've probably gone too far the way we've used the earth so far, and what is needed to bring some kind of a balance is more a change of attitude. And not just quick jumping to one model or the other model, but blending the two together. And over time, if we change our attitudes toward go back more toward the kinship model, perhaps things will be better.
We're just about at the end of our time here, but I would like to take 1 minute, no more, and then we'll let you go so you can take this conversation to lunch with you. What's your thought about this document as a first step for the church? helpful, unhelpful, good points, bad points, if you were going to give some very quick feedback based on your very cursory introduction to it, what might some of them be? I mean, Jim already mentioned one. It doesn't seem to deal with science much. Any other thoughts? Or?
Well, I have a thought. The church, it's great they produced this,
sure.
But I guess where are they going with it? How? Where's it going?
Where's it going? How's it going to get out there? Who's going to be dealing with it?
They're writing documents all day.
Right.
And rhetoric. But what direction are they going with it? That's what I don't understand.
So without a good distribution of the educational system, it's just another piece of paper in the file.
Well, by the same token, you've got to start someplace. And, you know, I think when you take a step forward and you write something down and you have something to bounce off of, to fix, to, you know, to do with, and you've got to make a statement, some way to begin.
So this structure is a good first start.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think so, yeah.
But it's interesting that nobody in this room raised their hand and even knew about the document.
No.
And how long has it been out?
It's 1991, and it's the process is 2 years, and they want to get all their input by January 1st, 1993. So we still have about 4 months.
4 months, but there's
a... So it's copyright 92 on this one. Didn't even know.
Pardon?
Copyright 92 on this one.
Okay, I'm just reading the cover section here, but yeah, anyway.
Copyright 92.
Yeah. Well, we need to let you all go to lunch. I encourage you to take these with you, talk about them, and if you've got any comments, drop a postcard to these folks and let them know. Thanks very much for coming, everyone.